Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank Professor Bodenschatz and Professor Falkovich for giving me the opportunity to attend this program. And this is the title of my talk. And this study is a joint... I'm Takashi Ishihara from Nagoya University.
You need to talk a little louder. I think this thing is so loud.
Okay. This study is a joint work with Professor Hunt in University College of London and Professor Kaneda in Nagoya University. In the nature, there are many turbulence phenomena which have very sharp interfaces. Regarding the turbulent and non-turbulent interfaces in homogeneous turbulence, extensive studies have been done. But the Reynolds numbers in these studies are not so high. Our impression is that the interfaces become sharper as the Reynolds number increases. However, our knowledge of the sharp interfaces in high Reynolds number turbulence seems to be insufficient. This figure shows high enthalpy regions obtained by DNS of high Reynolds number turbulence with 4,000 cubic grid points and the Taylor microscale Reynolds number about over 1,000. This figure suggests that the intense vorticity regions form tube-like structures with a radius of order Kolmogorov length scale, and the cluster of these vortex tubes, intense vortex tubes, form layer-like structures.
Sorry, question.
Hi.
What are we visualizing?
This is an isosurface of enthalpy. Enthalpy is the square of vorticity.
Okay.
This figure shows intensity distribution of energy dissipation, rate of energy dissipation, and enthalpy on a cross-section obtained by the DNS with a Taylor microscale Reynolds number, 675. We can observe a layer-like structures in this figure. Professor Hunt pointed out that this is a typical shear layer in high Reynolds number turbulence. So my question is this really a typical structure in high Reynolds number turbulence? So this is a typical fluctuation of a velocity component normalized by its root mean square. As you can see, there are big velocity jumps within the distance of order Taylor microscale. And the jump, the magnitude of the jump is order root mean square values. So the question is, what is the connection between big velocity jump and high vorticity regions? And how can we characterize them? So the purpose of this study is to characterize sharp interfaces and thin shear layers in high Reynolds number turbulence using 4,000 cubed DNS data of turbulence. Here is the outline of my talk. First, I will give a short introduction of our DNS data of high Reynolds number turbulence. Then I will show you recent results of data analysis. In this main part, firstly, I show you a typical layer-like structure with sharp interfaces. Then I will give a short introduction of the method of conditional analysis. This method is this method was used by Lester Weil et al. And this method is to characterize the interface and thin shear layers. in tablets. Then I will show you conditional kinematic results and conditional statistics which relate to the dynamics of the layer. Then I will show, I will give a short summary of my talk. In the DNS, we solved forced incompressible Navier-Stokes equations under periodic boundary conditions. As the forcing, we use negative viscosity at low wave number range to keep total energy constant. And we use an alias-free Fourier spectral method and force order Lumecuta method for time matching. We performed two series of DNS with different resolutions. In series one, the number of Kmax eta is approximately equal to one, and in series two, the number of Kmax eta is approximately equal to two. This number is correspond to the number of mesh points in the within the distance about three times Kolmogorov frame scale. And the number of grid points in our simulations ranged from 256 cubed to 4,000 cubed. We performed these simulations on the Earth simulator in 2002. The detail of the DNS is written in these references. Here are the turbulent characteristics at a statistical steady state of turbulence obtained by this DNS. Here is the number of grid points in one direction. Here is the Taylor microscale Reynolds numbers. The data in red color is from series one, and data in blue box is from series two. The maximum Reynolds number is obtained in series one and 4,000 cubed grid points. The Taylor-Maxwell-scale Reynolds number is 1,000. And the ratio of integral length scale to the Kolmogorov length scale is about 2,000. So we use this data to analyze the structures in high Reynolds number turbulence. So, these lines are compensated energy spectrum obtained by our DNS data. And here is a normalized second order structure function obtained by our DNS data. This figure shows a Kolmogorov scaling predicted by Kolmogorov theory. These data are consistent to the Kolmogorov theory. And here is a normalized energy flux. And as you can see, here is a constant region. The normalized energy flux is, this normalization is made by using mean rate of energy dissipation. So this constant, one equal, means the energy flux is constant in the inertial range and equals to the mean rate of energy dissipation. And we can also confirm the four-fifths law. And the range, plateau range, is getting wider as the Reynolds numbers.
What's this black solid line?
What's this?
The black solid line.
This is a theoretical estimate, but
it makes the data look prettier.
Yeah.
It just makes the data look prettier than it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take that line out, you see that the scaling range is actually quite short in the third order structure function.
Yeah.
I mean, at lambda 1000, the red line is just touching for, I would say, like like 20, not even a decade of scaling, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, I see. So what's the theoretical prediction?
Made by Professor Kaneda. We use the estimate of the forcing.
I see.
So this is a for specific value for this curve.
So the theory is a fit to the data, to this experiment, there's some kind of parameters in the theory.
Based on the Kalman-Hawass equation, we estimate viscosity term and forcing term. Then we can estimate these curves.
Okay. So do you understand why the why your structure functions are?
This one?
You know, this is a logarithmic scale. If you would plot this on a linear scale, I mean, you know, if you plot this from 1 to 2 instead of from 1 to 10, then there's quite a bit of difference between the structure functions. So why? So the highest order, the highest Reynolds numbers are not really resolving, right? I mean, for small scales, all the other ones are lying pretty much on top of each other. But for smaller scales, the red one is below. What I'm saying here. I'm just these are tiny effects, right? But here, this one is here higher and here it's lower.
Yeah.
Than the green one, right? So the green one is pretty much. And so, why do you know why this goes down here? Why the small scales we should really collapse go actually down? There's a trend, right? Is that because you're pushing the limits of the resolution of your code? Is it the orange one is here?
Yes.
And then the blue one is somewhere on the green one, and then the green one is here, and then the red one is even below.
Yeah.
And so, do you understand why that is happening? It's because the resolution of the code is not. I mean, the code is pushing the limits of its resolution. You would think that in this range you should have no problems, right? You would think that in this range everything should collapse if it's universal.
Yeah.
You have the same forcing scheme, you have the same everything, it's just higher Reynolds number. So you would think that only at the large scales things should, at the small scales, so forcing has changed. So that means your forcing has changed? Or?
No, forcing is the same.
It's the same. Well, it's just busy.
I think this is not comes from the new math.
You think that's real?
So when the Reynolds number becomes larger and larger, so the intermittent effect manifests. That means the second order moment does not flow the power to itself. So more usually its value is about 0.7. So then by dividing by the R to the 2/3, the slope must be a little bit.
Oh, you're saying that in reality the second order gets a little steeper, the 2/3.
Steeper, or the right side will be going up a little bit.
Right, so you have a little bit of a spectral bump there. There's a little bit of a bottleneck. That's what you're saying. There's a bottleneck.
It's an intermittent effect.
I see. You're saying this, you see the intermittent effect right there.
Yeah.
Okay?
As you have seen, the data so far are consistent with the classical theory of turbulence. However, the data also show that intermittent nature, which cannot be explained by the classical theories of turbulence. These results show that the intermittent nature becomes stronger as the Reynolds number increase. Here is an example of the data. This is a probability density function of longitudinal velocity derivatives. As Reynolds number increase, the tail become larger. And the flatness of this longitudinal velocity derivatives is an increasing function of Reynolds number. So the question is, what does happen in high Reynolds number turbulence? And what is the relation between the structure and the intermittent nature of turbulence? So from here, I explain our DNS data analysis. In our data analysis, we use the same method used by Westerwil et al. to analyze the turbulent, non-turbulent interface of a jet. But differently from the analysis, we have to, firstly, we have to find the location of the interfaces from a huge data set. For the sake of the easiness of the handling the huge dense data, we divided a 4,000 cube box into 512 boxes like this. And each box still has 500 cubed grid points. And we labeled each box by as NX, NY, NZ. So here is a ranking of high entropy. For example, maximum entropy is attained at the subcube number 455, and the minimum is obtained at the subcube 278. This table shows that the entropy is not uniformly distributed in these subcubes. So, a typical layer-like structure can be found in this subcube. So, from here, we focus on this subcube.
This is a snapshot.
Yes, yes. Here is a high entropy region obtained in the subcube 465. The size of this length is 512 mesh size, which corresponds to 0.72 integral length scale and 23 teramicron scale and this so on. So this figure shows that elongated vortices are confined roughly in a layer-like region. So,
how do you find the vortices that are confined in the plane? Do you tunnel?
Yeah, turn around. So, from this side, the region is not so layer-like. But from this direction, this is almost layer-like.
So the layers are wide again? It's
wide.
The layer, I mean, I have to, so this is 0.72, it's almost L.
Yeah, here is 0.72 L.
So how, so it's about one along, and how wide is it?
Yeah, I will show you.
Because for an experiment, it would mean that it's a whole experiment. Because most experiments, other than wind tunnel experiments, have only roughly one L, which is hopefully kosher, you know, I mean, definitely the French washing machine. You will only investigate one L. Anything larger than an L, you wouldn't trust the data anymore because you're in the mixing regions of the propellers. So
to see rough structure, coarse graining is effective. This figure is obtained by using coarse graining, using a 3D Gaussian filter with a characteristic length scale. For 50 Kolmogorov length scale.
What's plotted?
Here is the isosurface of coarse grained amplitude of coarse grained vortices. Yes. This shows that coarse grained vortices aligns in the plane of the layer. This direction. And in this figure, isosurface of coarse-grained vorticity are indicated by the color depending on the value of the Y component of coarse-grained vorticity. Here is the color map, and the negative side is colored by yellow or green, and the positive side is colored by blue or purple. And this shows here is almost the yellow color indicates the Y components of coarse graining vorticity is almost negative everywhere in the layer. So to perform much detailed analysis, let us consider a slice of the domain. And this red point corresponds to the top left corner of this figure, and this point, blue point, correspond to the top right corner of this figure. And this is a contour plot of entropy, and you can see there is a layer of high entropy region, and with very sharp interface, left and left interface and right interface. The left and the right figure shows respectively the intensity distribution of entropy and dissipation on a cross section of the subdomain 4, 6, 5. This figure demonstrates that not only the entropy but also the dissipation, energy rate of energy dissipation, is intense in the layer-like region. Following the method used by Westerwil et al., we define the interface as a set of the outermost point that satisfy a certain threshold of entropy. We use this threshold. Omega is the entropy averaged over the four domain. The location of the interface is quite insensitive to the choice of the threshold. In order to exclude isolated vortices, we select an appropriate starting point for a given value of Z. For example, here is the entropy profile obtained in this along this line. So, for example, if we start from this point, we search, we have, this is the left interface. And if we start from this point, this is the left interface, right interface. But if we start from, for example, this point, our algorithm detects here is the interface, but we want to define the interface is the outermost point of this the layer. So we choose the starting point by hand. In this figure, the red line is a set of starting point we used, and the light blue and pink lines are the left and right interfaces just obtained. Our analysis is applied only for this Z range because the boundary of the layer-like region is not clear outside of this range. So the size of this range is about 0.35 L. This is the answer of the question by Professor Bodenschatz. And the average width of the layer is about 3.2 teramicroscale. And to characterize the layer, we define, here is the inside the layer, we call this region in, and here we call the left side left, we call this right side right. So here let us define the conditional statistics. The average with subscript L is the average of F over the Z range, over this Z range, conditioned on the distance psi from the left interface, XL. Average with subscript R is defined similarly, but using the left right interface, XR. These are the function of psi from the distance. This xi distance from the interface.
Excuse me, could you go back one slide? What is the point which has x equal zero, for example, left?
Yeah, yeah, x equal zero is here.
There, okay.
Yeah. So these are the average of F over the each domain in left, right. And we also use the term out, which is the left and right. And the normal average, we denote normal average by this mark. So this figure shows the conditional statistics of entropy. The left one is the conditional statistics which characterize the left interface. The value is normalized by using the entropy averaged over the four domain. The right one is the right one characterizes the right interface. And here is a function. These are plotted as a function of xi, normalized by mesh size. And this arrow points towards the layer side from c equals zero. And the length of the arrow indicates the 4 times tera microscale. As you can see, the entropy in the layer is over 10 times of the 10 times larger than the average, and the width of the layer is about 4 to 5 teramicroscale, and we can see the sharp peaks here, left interface and right interface. And the width of this peak is about 10 eta. And we can observe that
the peak, which peak?
This one.
Is about 10 eta.
And this one. And as you can see, the right side is sharper than the left side. Here is a histograms of logarithmics of square of vorticity normalized by entropy averaged over the four domain. These are the histograms obtained inside the layer and outside the layer, and red curve is the histograms obtained in subcube 465, and blue line is the curve obtained by the four box. As you can see, the form of the histograms is nearly Gaussian. And the shapes of the histograms are similar, nearly Gaussian. And in shear layer, the mean is larger than the others. And variance is smaller than the others. The similar is also true for the histograms of logarithmics of energy dissipation rate, normalized by the average. As you can see, the variance are small as compared with those of entropy, but the shapes of the histograms is similar, independently from the domains, but the average is different. So next, I will show you third and fourth order moments of velocity gradients. The normalized this figure shows a conditional average of third order moments of longitudinal velocity derivatives normalized by using second order moments. obtained by using the for domain average. In the so-called skewness and flatness obtained by using the for data set is about -0.6 and 10.7. But the average obtained, but the conditional third order and fourth order moment, the magnitude is very large as compared to these values. So the
the denominators, the values of all domain?
Yes. So this means the layer contributes very large values of the, for example, this one and this one. The contribution is very large. And these numbers are the average of the this third order moments and fourth order moments obtained inside the layer, using the data inside the layer. This figure shows the same data as in previous one, but for the transverse derivatives. And in isotropic turbulence, the skewness is must be zero, but the conditional third order moments has at the layer side has a very large values. This suggests that the flow is strongly anisotropic in the layer, and there is a net mean shear across the layer. I'm sorry, here, W is a velocity component approximately parallel to the layer. And as you can see, the fourth order moment is also large in the layer, much larger than the flatness obtained by the using full data, full DS domain data. So, not only the conditional third and fourth order moments, but also conditional variance of velocity derivatives is large in the layer. So to see the relation between the conditional second order moments and conditional third and fourth order moments, we use as a denominator this values, conditional second order moments. So as you can see, there is no significant difference between inside and outside the layer. And the value is approximately equal to -0.6, which is the skewness of this longitudinal derivative obtained obtained by the using the average over the whole domain. And also the flatness normalized by this conditional variance, the value is only slightly below the flatness factor of longitudinal derivative obtained by using the data for DNS domain data. So next I will show you a conditional velocity components. Here is the histograms of both velocity components normalized by using a root mean square value of velocity components. As you can see, this red histogram is obtained using near but outside the layer. And this one is from in the layer. As you can see, the shapes has no big difference in components, but very large negative values in one component. conditional average of vorticity component, something like this. And the magnitude of vorticity inside the layer is about 0.78 times root mean square value of vorticity. This means that in the layer, normally the average of vorticity component is almost zero, but in the layer, the average is order one of order of the root mean square value of the vorticity components. And this figure shows the probability density function of vorticity component in the layer and near but outside the layer. The shape is very similar, but for example, skewness in the layer is slightly larger than the in Y components. And skewness and flatness near but outside the layer have larger magnitude than those in the layer. This is the result. So this shows a conditional vorticity components omega y. Here is the layer side. As you can see in this figure, there is a clear tendency that the conditional average of y components of vorticity take negative values in the layer. And the negative peak in here is very large. We can observe a very large negative peak here at the light interface. And next, I will show you the conditional velocity components. This figure shows that the average conditional velocity u is a normal approximately normal component to the layer, and which is nearly negative. This shows the layer and the neighbor is moved towards the minus x directions. And outside the layer, the velocity is almost constant, and the velocity decreases gradually from minus 0.5 to minus, for example, minus 1.7. And there is a sharp change near the light interface, which corresponds to this sharp peak. So this is our image of the velocity. Here is the light interface, and velocity changes here, and velocity changes here sharply. And this is a conditional velocity W. W is the approximate parallel components to the layer. And as you can see, the W change increase gradually from minus 1.3 to 0.3. As you can see, the change is sharper near the light interface.
Why is there a, I'm just curious, why is there a sharp jump in the transverse velocity at the right interface? I would have thought that the normal velocity would be kind of continuous, right, to maintain the interface.
Why this is sharper?
The previous one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering why there is a jump over there. You know what I mean? I never thought that the normal velocity would become continuous to maintain the interface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are several reasons, I think. Because, for example, the interface is sharper in the light interface, and the velocity difference from here and here is much larger.
Yeah,
Yeah, so so this is the reason for the sharp jump, for example, here.
But how does the large scale velocity field look like this? Well, when you make a cut,
yeah,
and you take a picture and you average your velocity field over a certain length space, let's say 50 meters, what does it look like? What does the streamlines? What do the streamlines look like? Is it just a vortex, or is it just going around? Is it a large turnaround region, and you get a large shear layer? That's basically what's happening, right?
Yeah.
It must be. I mean, this thing is coming, right, and then it just turns left or right. We don't know which way, but it doesn't go straight. You don't have a plot of the kind of the heat flow.
Heat flow?
Well, you know, of the flow around this.
Yeah. I have a. And here, the histograms of velocity components normalized by root mean square values. The histograms obtained outside the layer is nearly Gaussian. This is UVW, nearly Gaussian. But the histograms obtained inside the layer is strongly non-Gaussian. And this distribution is correlated to the superpose of these distributions. And this negative values and the difference of the values indicate these relation. And these two is a this size is this direction, and this size is this direction. Here is the mean shear, and the vorticity is from this direction. So here I will ask you a question. Here is a large scale structure of shear layer. This figure shows the counterplot of y component of vorticity. The green is negative and blue is positive. And here is the streamlines. And flow is this direction. And we can see the large swirling flow near the layer. And the direction of velocity changes sharply at the interface. Okay. So, sudden change of direction of velocity at the shear layer, which is the big velocity jump, which corresponds to the big velocity jump across the layer.
Sudden change,
Here, for example.
Like characteristics of the atmospheric front.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
So you can
exactly.
It just
looks like that.
Yeah, that has the same features.
Okay. So here is a similar plot obtained at slightly upper sections. The slightly upper means a section. This section is the same normal vector, and the distance between the previous one is 154 mesh size, which corresponds to about 3.5 paramicroscale. As you can see, here is a spiral-like structure. So this shows that the layer we analyze is a part of a spiral. Large-scale spiral structure. So here is a quantitative change of the velocity direction. Here is a average obtained by inside the layer. Here is the left and right. We can define the angle between these velocities. And the angle between in and right is much larger than in and left, which correspond to the sharp change at the right interface. And velocity difference between left and right is about, the magnitude of velocity difference is about 2.4 root mean square value of velocity. And the inside the layer, the as I can, I showed before, the average is about 0.78 omega prime. These values is consistent because, for example, this value times the average width of the layer is the same order. So these values are consistent. So next, I will show the small scale structure in the layer. There are many maximum and minima of the velocity components in the turbulence field. So in order to characterize this fluctuation, let us consider the difference between the maxima and nearest local minima, delta W, and the distance between the these two maxima and minima. Here is a probability density function of delta omega normalized by root mean square value of velocity. The green curve is obtained from the data inside the layer, and blue one is obtained by the data outside the layer. As you can see, a very large jump can occur in the inside the layer. And this is a probability density function of delta x normalized by eta. Here, as you can see, the PDF of this value is smaller. So this shows the probability of large jump delta W is higher in inside the layer than the outside the layer. But the distance delta X is in general smaller in inside the layer than the outside the layer. So this is very, I think, important data because, so for example, the order one jump can be observed inside the layer, the probability is about 0.01, very high, I think. And the this jump is occur about 20 or 30, the order of 20 or 30 teramicroscale, Kolmogorov-Lenz scale. This is more clearly shown by the conditional, joint probability density function of delta omega and delta x. This is obtained using the data inside the layer. This is obtained by using the data outside the layer. As you can see, for example, this is a joint PDF, and this is a conditional average, and you can see order the jump of order u prime occur at, for example, 50 times teramicroscale. So very large jump within the distance of order 10 or 20 times Kolmogorov-Lenz scale. So I will show from here statistics related to the conditional statistics related to the dynamics of the layer. First one is for barrier effect of the layer. To test whether the shear layer acts as a barrier to the fluctuation outside the layer, we consider conditional cross correlation of the velocity fluctuation. Let the fluctuation F tilde L and its two-point correlation CLF XXE prime be defined as like this, where F sub L is the average of F conditioned on the distance C from XL. FR and CRF can be defined similarly using the light interface. Here is the result of two-point correlations. This characterizes the left interface. This characterizes the right interface. And here, this side is inside the layer. So, as you can see, the correlation are higher if the two points are outside the layer. But lower if the two points are different sides of the one of the two interfaces. And we can see very sharp change near the right interface. So, barrier effect can be observed in U component, which is a normal component to the layer at the right edge of the shear layer.
Excuse me, does it mean that you observe, you have shown the structure of the flow,
yeah,
kind of rotating vortex here,
yeah,
and the barrier is in the middle and it's an obstacle to the rotation? So relative flow is slower. So the right interface is just a kind of interface when the external flow hits onto barrier.
Yeah.
And the left hand side interface is some end of the barrier. Yes, this is.
Yeah, but the light side is. Left side is also the hit, but the hit is smaller than the light side. Okay, so relative velocity is larger at the light interface. So lastly, I will show you the conditional statistics. Related to the lattice of the layer, the second topic is the energy transfer. So here, energy transfer, the function of x and k is a t x k is the energy transfer at the point shown x across the wave number k, and is defined as like this. Here is a bar is a filtering operation using the spectral cut filter. This is used in the context of LES, and there are many studies on this quantity. The spatial average of this T is the energy flux, and this means that spatial average of T, which is correspond to the energy flux, is almost constant in the inertial range. But the result of DNS shows that the variance of energy transfer normalized by using energy dissipation is much larger than 1. And this is an increasing function of wave number. And the energy transfer defined before this one is take both positive and negative values, and very intermittent. So I will study the energy transfer near the layer. Here is the intense distribution of energy dissipation, and here is a distribution of energy transfer at using the this wave number and this wave number. The wave number, this wave number correspond to here, and this is much large scales, and this is for the small scale. As you can see, not only the value, but also the variance is large near the layer.
So the large variance means that the higher elevation of mountain conduct.
Yeah, this is also positive and negative, but average is much higher. We have to.
Where do we see the average?
Does this reflect the intermittency?
I'm sorry, I skipped the.
So anyhow, the average
means that average elevation of the average of T inside the layer is about 10 times the average of the enthalpy. Yeah, this is also the same. I'm sorry. This figure shows the variation is very large near the layer. And
does this reflect the intermittency?
Yeah. So this is a conditional histograms, and the this broken curves is obtained by using the full data set, and this solid line is using the data inside the layer, and this dotted line is using the data outside the layer. So this figure shows the energy transfer inside the layer contribute the large deviations of energy transfer. But if we if we normalize these quantities using the standard deviation obtained obtained using the each domain's data, so the shapes of PDF is almost the similar. So here is a summary of my talk. To study the properties of strong syncia layer in high-level number turbulence, we analyze DNS data with 4,000 cube grid points, and our lambda is about 1,000. In high-level number turbulence, high vortex region form tube-like structures, and the clusters of the tube-like structures form strong shear layers. Shear layer has sharp interfaces at both sides, and sharp peak with width about 10 times eta, and the layer width is about 4 to 5 teramicroscale. And enthalpy within the layer is greater than 10 times the average. And there are very strong velocity jumps of order u prime, root mean square value of velocity, within the distance of order 10 eta in the layer. And the interface acts as a barrier to the fluctuations outside the layer, and the energy transfer T is active and intermittent near the layer. T within the layer is greater than 10 times the average. It is very large in the layer and also large near the layer. And the form of PDF of T within the layer is similar to that for total domain. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. So I didn't understand why you can say it's a barrier. So you would have to look at Lagrangian properties or something. I mean, it could be chicken and the egg problem, right? You could say that the chicken is different from the egg, but you don't know which one was first, right? So it could be that you have a layer, you have a strong shear layer. Because of that, you produce a lot of vorticity and a lot of dissipation, and the layer is confined because the mechanism is confined. That doesn't mean there's a barrier. That just means it's a result of two flows hitting each other at very high velocities and shearing at very high shear. And as a result of that, you see a lot of instabilities, and that those generate, you know, the vorticity. So it's not a barrier. It's not holding. It's not keeping something out. It's just an effect of the fluid. So it's just a localized shear layer.
Yeah, it's a vortex sheet that they.
It's just the word like shear layer. So have you looked at at pressure gradients and acceleration? Because I would expect that the pressure gradients would go up and, there.
Yeah, higher.
Go very high. Yeah. And so in the experiments, what we see is we see usually when you look for very low pressure, what you can do is you can either put bubbles in or you can pump down the liquid, and then you get cavitation events. Mm-hmm. And you usually see lines. And so the question is, these things probably also, if you would look just if you look at just pressure. Uh-huh. And you put a window on pressure, you know, some number like you had 0.78. Do you see a sheet or do you see lines? Mm-hmm. It would be interesting.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we have the data, but I have not yet to be honest.
The direction is also important. If the pressure gradient is into the
direction.
Way, so the particle can.
I was hoping it's low pressure. Yeah, I was hoping it's low pressure. It would be high pressure. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but if the gradient goes this way, so the particle cannot enter. In that sense, the outer layer may be after the barrier, but I'm not sure.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. Any more questions?
Just a comment on the other question. The comment is that I'm not too comfortable with the way you did the definition of the layer. This was very grid-centric, you know. I was hoping to see a more multi-scale approach.
Uh-huh.
They exist, you know, using wavelets and things like that. Just look across the scales and aim for where there's a. It's a more objective way, I'd say.
No.
It doesn't use a threshold. It's more flow of energy in the wavelet space. And then you could define your distances to the interface more like off-grid, you know, I'd say. I don't think it would change the conclusions. It would just be more elegant. Obviously, you had to choose a. My other question is about this motivation.
On the bottom, there's. Did you go down? On the bottom of the little screen?
Some of the difference use a wavelet method to define that. Yeah, so I have to study that method.
Yes. My question was about this picture here. I was just wanted you to go back to this picture and give me some insights about what's going on. I know this is not a passive scalar. It's not same kind of turbulence here. There's all kinds of things going on here, but I was hoping we can.
So how wide were these things? They were about 50 ETA?
What?
I mean, how wide were the sheets? The sheets were about, how wide were they?
Wide?
How wide, yeah. 50 ETA, right? 50 Kolmogorov-Knox scales or 100 Kolmogorov-Knox scales?
Widths is about 3 or 5 teramicrosecond.
Okay, well, now we have to know how many. I'd like to see Kolmogorov.
Yeah.
I can. About 10. So it's about 100 Kolmogorov distances, is that? Yeah, what's the Taylor microscale compared to the Kolmogorov distance? We can prove it.
Yeah. We have to.
Yeah, it's 1,000 ETA. Okay, so it's 1,500 ETA is the box, right? That's the size of the whole box. And so it's probably like 200-300 ETA, and what is an ETA in the atmosphere is about a millimeter. Right, so it's about a meter. So these things are big.
Yeah.
I can't call them big.
Well, they're like a meter or 2 meters wide. I mean, this is quite substantial. I mean, but not in the real world.
Not in the real world, on the cloud.
Yeah, well, I mean,
clouds come on.
Well, that counts not a kilometer.
I think it
is.
I mean, just precipitate,
but not light.
Precipitate. It's precipitating, right? Right. Hmm? From an airport, for an aircraft, you're looking at a cloud. The cloud is huge.
Yeah.
And I think you're trying to tell us or visualize the this convection structure, this tower, is a little bit like your interface, right? In cloud, out of cloud.
I don't think that's what he implies. I think what he implies is that at the where the thing is rising and the stuff is coming out, there's a very strong interface, right? And but what you're saying is that forget about the buoyancy effects and everything, you still get very strong interfaces of the on the scale of a meter, just in homogeneous isotropic turbulence without anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I don't know what that does to the cloud. I have no idea. What happens to the problems? Yeah.
The problem is the following. We have no measurements of this resolution in clouds.
Yeah. Of a meter.
The meter resolution is the best measured resolution from most of the experiments you can get at turbulence.
But you should see a jump in the, like when Holger Siebert or you guys do hot wire measurements.
This is one case of very specific measurements he did. Okay, so far. Struggling with the others. So
are they jumps, very strong velocity jumps? I mean,
yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They are, and they are on the largest case as well.
They are at how?
I will talk about it tomorrow.
You will talk about it tomorrow. Okay.
Okay.
Very good. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you.